Welcome to the First Things podcast. On this episode, I'll talk with editor Rusty Reno and special guest Midge Dechter about Michael Novak, who died this month. Gentle but direct, Novak saw his way through the neocon transition from left to right and made a very influential moral case for capitalism. And like all good people and Pennsylvanians, he was a football fan. Then, I'll talk to literary editor Matthew Schmitz about a feature article from the next issue of First Things. It's a defense of the traditional Catholic liturgy from the German writer Martin Mosebach, and we're very excited about it. Matthew will also overview his own arguments about the post-Vatican II class divide in Catholic liturgy and practice. I'm associate editor Julia Yost. Thanks for joining us. On February 17th, Michael Novak died. He was, among other things, a Catholic, a sometime seminarian and sometime liberal, a theologian and public intellectual, a sports fan, author of The Spirit of Democratic Capitalism, and a co-conspirator in the founding of First Things. Here to discuss Novak's life and work are First Things editor Rusty Reno and Midge Dechter, who knew and worked with Novak back when First Things was still a twinkle in Father Newhouse's eye. Midge, thanks for joining us.
It's a pleasure to be here.
So Michael Novak wore many hats and accomplished many things. Midge and Rusty, could you give us your best effort at describing and assessing his achievements?
Well, I knew Michael through the period of his developing into a spokesman for the church and capitalism and the United States. And he was a man of many parts. But when I think about him, I think about him personally, because he was about as complicated a person as I've ever known, even more complicated than Father Richard Newhouse, and that's saying something. I also had the opportunity to be his editor because I worked for a brief unhappy time at a book publishing company and published two books by him. Not about capitalism, not about the church, not about faith, but about sports, and one which was his favorite and my favorite.
Which sports?
Well, all sports, but of course his real sport was football. That was the real passion of his sports
Western
life.
Pennsylvania.
That's it, yeah. Yes.
But he was a Notre Dame fan, wasn't he?
He was a Notre Dame fan, but he was mainly a football crazy. That's what he was.
Because he was a member, he was in formation in the Holy Cross Order, which is the one that runs Notre Dame. And so he had an existential connection to Notre Dame. And he was ambivalent, to say the least, about the direction of Notre Dame over the last couple of decades. But about the football team, he never wavered.
Well, when I first met him, he was young. He had three very small kids. He was teaching, I can't even remember which school on Long Island, which was a very odd institution. And that's when I met him, and he was, as was I, a flaming liberal, which didn't last very long in either case. But he actually saw this thing called capitalism. He saw what was going to be required if one grew very sad and gloomy about what was happening to the left in American society. And he saw this right away. I mean, for many of us who were called neoconservatives, capitalism was not exactly the issue. Mm-hmm. It was more cultural and so on. But he saw his way very quickly to the point.
That's interesting because he recognized that he had to take the full measure of
yes, he did.
These economic matters.
He did. Why? Why do I think that was? Well, I could give you some kind of biographical account of this. He was a boy from Pennsylvania, mm-hmm. and he knew he went to the heart of things very quickly as a consequence. But I'm not sure I know. We were all in a tangle in those days, and recognizing there were going to be consequences to our turning against the left. The one thing we were not was anti-American. Mm-hmm. And that's the thing, the pin on which everything else was hung. We were a generation which had come through World War II, and by God, that war ended in a high note of patriotism. We met him at that point, but I really got to know him better later. For a period, we all became embattled, and there's nothing like being embattled alongside somebody to cement your relations.
So when was that exactly?
Oh dear, you're going to ask me to remember the year. Well, I would say it was 1970, 68, 70, 72.
Yeah, I was just wondering whether it was in the 60s, 70s, or going into the 80s, but I guess...
No, it was the 60s, 70s. Okay. Oh yes, absolutely.
All right. Well, let us move into the 80s and talk about The Spirit of Democratic Capitalism, which is Novak's 1982 book, regarded by most people, I think, as his masterpiece. It spells out the moral dimension of political economy, and it's turned out, I think, to be a very important book. So comments on that, its thesis, its significance?
Well, I was a young college student in the late 70s, and Solzhenitsyn's Gulag Archipelago came out in the mid 70s, and really, I think for a lot of folks, communism was becoming untenable for all kinds of reasons. But at the same time, I think the consensus was still pretty strong among my generation that capitalism, while maybe the best way to produce wealth and so on, was really regrettable. Do you think that was true, Mitch? There was that kind of feeling that, well, this is the system, maybe we have to go with this one, but socialism was still the morally superior system, even though we kind of realized it wasn't probably going to work at the practical level.
Well, that's, you see, that's a generation after us. That was not Michael. Because once you discovered that 2 + 2 = 4, the rest of it went very quickly. There were no fooling around anymore. And he maybe got there earlier than most. I believe he got there earlier, for instance, than Richard Neuhaus, though I'm not altogether certain about the dates of Richard's transformation.
Yeah, I mean, the genius of the book was to identify the way in which a free economy provides a basis on which to not just bring out freedom, which is the element that, you know, the National Review crowd always championed, but that it actually contributes to all kinds of elements of a healthy society.
Virtue, right? It requires the exercise of virtue,
right.
And so reinforces
and
it.
And the cooperative nature, and also the spiritual, you know, God tells Adam and Eve to till and keep the garden and exercise dominion, and that there's a way in which the enterprise of enterprise is itself an ennobling thing. And again, to back to my youth, you know, there was the utilitarian arguments in favor of free enterprise, pretty compelling, you know. But that's pretty thin beer for a young person that wants political economy to serve more noble ends than just the creation of wealth. And Michael's genius was to be able to bring forward in a very compelling way how a free economy really promotes promotes the common good in all kinds of ways. And that's why the book had such a tremendous influence.
Michael was the first one who made this an issue of ethics. You could say sin and goodness. A lot of us were Jews, and so the journey was not as straightforward as it was in Michael's case. He saw what he saw, and then he was all in. And that was what Michael was like. Of course, he was always all in whatever he was in, including football.
And one of the things that characterized, I think, his career, those decades when he made that shift from left to right, is he carried on an ongoing campaign against the presumptive leftism of Catholicism. And which I think was very healthy, because there's an uncritical quality to this, that as if good intentions can be a substitute for actual philosophical and theological analysis. And I mean, many people think that spirit of democratic capitalism, which kind of circulated around in typescript form in Poland before it was published, influenced John Paul II and Centesimus Annus in 1991, which was the high watermark of the Vatican's affirmation of capitalism, I think was certainly influenced, not just by Michael, but also by George Weigel, Richard John Neuhaus, and their circle of folks, both in Poland and in Rome, trying to take the full measure of where we need to go after the fall of the Soviet Union. And it was a morally serious assessment of capitalism, its strengths and its weaknesses. And I think Michael is often unjustly criticized by many people on the left as a kind of shell for capitalism, when in fact I think he had a very thoroughgoing sense of the moral framework by which we should assess political economy broadly. And he did not think that free markets were self-perpetuating, perpetual motion machines that would just take care of themselves. In fact, the last piece he wrote for us, in 2015 I think we published it, I asked him to write something on the spirit of democratic capitalism revisited. Mm-hmm. And in that, he said that in this present moment, in the 21st century, the greatest threat to capitalism is the loss of a moral and religious foundation for a free economy. That just having a deregulation and congenial conditions for business is not sufficient. There has to be a moral and political ballast in the system. He thought there were three legs to the stool of a free society. There were a free economy, democratic institutions, and a strong moral and religious culture.
Yes, I think that's so. And we were a very mixed bunch. It was a great shock to all of us, actually, to discover what it was we really thought. Mm. Perhaps it wasn't for Michael. Mm. I don't know. He was always so soft-spoken and gentle that it wasn't necessarily easy to trace his spiritual movement or his intellectual movement even, because the rest of us were fighting and quarreling and attacking and so on, and Michael spoke in a different tone of voice.
Yeah, it seems like he was not a rigorously aligned partisan. You know, he wasn't easily affiliated with a conventional party or what have you.
No, he wasn't. But that was partly a matter of style, too, because of the fact that he had a soft voice, unlike Richard Neuhaus, who was a tough guy.
He threw punches in his writing, Neuhaus.
Yes, yes. And
Public Square.
Yes. Yes, that's right. And he was so embattled. And I was an embattled Jew. So it was a better fit between us than Michael, whom I always loved. And one did love Michael, you see. I loved Richard Neuhaus, but I'm not sure that that was necessarily a widespread thing, because Richard didn't suffer fools gladly, and Michael did.
Well, he had a wonderful smile, and yeah, he did, and
right.
kind of a high, squeaky voice that was the opposite of intimidating, and so he could draw you in, and yeah, I can see that. Whereas Neuhaus, you know, he had a deep baritone voice and liked to command people.
Yes, he did, and he picked fights, and he didn't mind picking fights. And Michael had his fights too, but they were deceptive because of his demeanor. But I think it's very, very important, and it's probably very nervy for me to say this as a Jew, but John Paul too was the figure in the carpet. He was an enormous factor for everybody. I am not a light-minded Jew. I am a very passionate Jew, but he was vitally important to me. And it was Richard who made John Paul a figure in the foreground.
You figure, you know, as you were saying, you know, you and Richard and Michael, you know, came to these realizations in the late 60s and early 70s, this wasn't going to work. And things were really a mess in the 1970s. A mess across the board, politically, religiously, morally. I remember I was in high school in the mid-70s, and everything was coming apart. The teachers had lost any confidence that anybody would back them up. There were no real rules. You know, I didn't go to class, and the teachers didn't feel like they could punish me because no one really knew what the rules were now that the bottom had fallen out on everything. And John Paul II emerges in, you know, 1978, 1979. Here's a guy that really believes something. And the strength of his will, which was so palpable,
yes,
was very, I think, inspiring to folks who were trying to find their way to something solid.
But also his cheerfulness. John Paul made you feel that this was not only the right thing, it was making one pleased.
Mm-hmm.
I won't be so vulgar as to say happy, but accepting and pleased. And he did that. And nobody else did that. Richard couldn't do that. Michael provided the argument, but it was John Paul who was the real figure of that time. I mean, you can accept that from me because I was just a big-mouthed Jewish kid.
Mm-hmm.
and he took me over. That he was there, it's almost impossible to tell you how important that was for us. Now, you are a young guy, so your
fading
story
fast.
is slightly different. For us, World War II ended with the United States in love with itself. It was great, and we were foolish, no doubt. And we raised a bunch of terrible children. They were marvelous, much better than we in many respects, but not when it came to gratitude and appreciation. And of course, the war ended with America, the greatest, the most powerful, triumphant, getting rich, being busy. That lasted for only a minute. It lasted until our children got old enough to talk back. And then, wow. That was a whole different story. And so John Paul and what surrounded him, Michael, Richard, George Weigel, all of this was, it was like a discovery of something that we knew was lying there, but then we finally got our hands on it. And it was very inspiriting, and also it made us all very pugnacious. except Michael, who was never pugnacious. Never. I never heard him raise his voice. I know he was often disappointed in things or unhappy about things. You know, we were all storming around and writing stormy pieces and so on, and he never. His speaking voice was very soft, remained soft always, and that was like his writing voice, and that's really rare.
The times in which a new form is born are extremely rare in the history of mankind. Great forms are characterized by their ability to outlive the age in which they emerge and to pursue their path through all history's hiatuses and upheavals. The Greek column with its Doric, Ionic, and Corinthian capitals is such a form, as is the Greek tragedy. The Greeks regarded tradition itself as a precious object. It was tradition that created legitimacy. Among the Greeks, tradition stood under collective protection. The violation of tradition was called tyrannis. Tyranny is the act of violence that damages a traditional form that has been handed down. So begins Return to Form, the feature essay by Martin Mosebach, which appears in the forthcoming issue of First Things. Mosebach urges a return to the traditional Latin Mass, which was swamped by the liturgical changes undertaken in the revolutionary year, 1968. I'm joined by literary editor Matthew Schmitz, who midwifed this essay. Matthew, why don't you first tell us who Martin Mosebach is and why you asked him to write on this topic?
Martin Mosebach is a German novelist and essayist who writes on literary, political, and religious matters. He's won a whole series of literary prizes in Germany where he's regularly, you know, honored and, you know, in the kind of first rank of literary society. I read last winter a book of his essays published by Ignatius Press called The Heresy of Formlessness. Mosebach thinks very closely about the way that forms that may seem inessential actually express a profound reality and are perhaps even inextricable from it. It's a theme you see in his fiction, such as his novel What Was Before. It's his only novel to be translated into English, which I reviewed for First Things last year. You see it as well in his writings on the liturgy. I asked him to write an essay about the way that we are returning to tradition in all sorts of ways today. He didn't give me that exactly. He instead gave me this essay, which is really a battle cry for the restoration of the Roman Rite. But I think, though he didn't do exactly what I asked him, he fundamentally did. Because Mosebach believes that culture is something that grows up from a central cult. That's where the real ferment is. And in the West, to the extent that there is any Western civilization, it's what has grown up from the soil made fertile by the Roman Rite. In this essay, Mosebach traces the dramatic fortunes of the Latin Mass over the last 50 years. When the Council Fathers at Vatican II endorsed the Constitution on the liturgy, they wanted to open up greater reforms than had been common up to that point, but reforms that were still essentially modest. And the Mass, of course, has always been reformed. There have always been changes. What happened instead of the minor changes they envisioned, there was a massive, in a Mosebach's assessment, cataclysmic alteration of the Mass. Mosebach details why he thinks this represents a massive loss, praises, in a way that I think will shock our readers, the intransigence of Archbishop Marcel Lefebvre of the Society of St. Pius X, and then he calls for Catholics to put their shoulders to the wheel in bringing back the Latin Mass. He sees this, I think, ultimately as the fullness and the fruition of Benedict XVI's idea of the reform of the reform. Benedict XVI saw the two rites as mutually enriching. Mosebach thinks that that enrichment, you know, in the nature of things, will run mostly one way. The new form will tend more and more toward a stable old form.
One of the things that I thought was particularly interesting about this essay is one that you've mentioned as being potentially very controversial, and that is the supportive things that Mosebach has to say about the French Archbishop Marcel Lefebvre. So could you say a little bit more about who Lefebvre is, what his project has been, and what role does Mosebach see him playing in a positive way?
The Second Vatican Council represented a massive change in the form of the life of the Church. There was only one schism that resulted from it. That was the separation of the Priestly Society of St. Pius X, a group dedicated to the Latin Mass founded by Lefebvre, who had been a French missionary bishop to Africa. I think that Lefebvre's attachment to the Latin Mass probably had something to do with that missionary experience. You have this man who had seen the power of the Mass to win the hearts of people who couldn't possibly have found it more foreign. And so in an act of unbelievable defiance, he ordained three bishops to Cologne, Switzerland, and was then excommunicated. This was a great breach in the life of the Church. The Society of St. Pius X, far from withering away, has grown. And unlike most other such orders, it has not really drifted farther away from the Church. It hasn't sort of intensified in schism or gone away from the Church in heresy, which is a bit strange. Some members have, Bishop Richard Williamson, but as Benedict XVI pointed out in his most recent book of interviews, Bishop Williamson was a convert from Anglicanism. And I think Benedict says quite insightfully that Williamson was different from the other bishops in SSPX and many of the people in it because he had never been part of the great tradition of the Church. He went really from Anglicanism, one schismatic group, to another schismatic group. And so he never had a deep Catholic sensibility or sense of the great tradition of the Church. So since that act of defiance and those excommunications, there's been a great deal of work on both sides to try to reconcile the society to the Church. Benedict XVI had hopes for this, and Francis seems to have even keener hopes. So Mosebach's essay also comes in this very strange moment where we're probably on the cusp of another immense irony, where Francis, a pope who's not personally sympathetic to the Mass and is doing a great deal to bring the Church to wreck and ruin, will actually reinstate an order that is wholly opposed to his program.
At the end of the essay, Mosebach describes the appeal that might be exerted by the traditional Mass in our day. He says, "The old rite runs counter to the faith in progress that has long gone hand in hand with an economic mentality that is now curdling into an anxiety regarding the future. The movement that seeks to restore the form of the Latin Rite is still an avant-garde, attracting young people who find modern society suffocating." Now, Matthew, you're a bit of a trad, so you sort of have a sense of the outlook of the kinds of people who are involved in this restoration project. Could you give us your sense of who these people are?
Well, I can't claim to have a comprehensive sense of this. I go, as a rule, to the Tridentine Rite or Latin Mass, but I've only gone for about a year or so. Last year I read The Analects of Confucius and his sense of how ritual, social order, and great truth are all bound together disposes one to see the beauty, I think, of any ritual form, but especially of the old rite. When I was corresponding with Mosebach about this essay, I mentioned Confucius in passing because I think Mosebach's sensibility is very much that of a Western or Christian Confucius. And he thrilled to that name. He's very devoted to Confucius. So traditionalists, in my experience, are not people who simply read kind of Thomistic manuals. They often have got there by all sorts of routes. When I go to Mass, I see all kinds of people. John Rau, see him in a pew ahead of me. Prominent traditionalist writer. Also, my former professor at Princeton, P. Adam Sidney, who is a pioneering scholar of queer cinema and is basically a kind of extreme liberal on sexual and moral matters and an extreme ultra-conservative on liturgical ones. And I see many people who don't have names that are public, people who of all races, working people, more middle class people, But it really just seems the motley Catholic mix that you get in any kind of urban parish. So what is their sensibility? What draws them there? I don't know, but it strikes me very much that it's a diversity of people who are drawn to it.
Mosebach seems to suggest that there's a reaction against something. You know, something is missing, something is deficient, or something is suffocating, is his word, in modern society, which causes people to seek something different.
I wouldn't put it exactly in terms of suffocation. You know, suffocation, you run out of oxygen because you're in an enclosed space. I think that our current situation is more like being cast into outer space, where you have no oxygen because there's nothing around you constraining you. I wrote an essay, recent issue of First Things, on the Young Pope, this occasionally blasphemous, often boring HBO series. And that series captures really effectively the experience of people who came up after the generation that really imbibed and lived the ideal of the 1960s. The children of that generation, people like my friends and peers, you know, they've seen a world of freedom, a world where there are no forms, a world where nothing is rigid, where authorities pretend and said to be simply therapeutic supports, where no relationships are rigorously defined, and they found that didn't give them freedom, it actually stripped them of stability and security. So I think there's, among people who have come up after the 1960s, a definite sense, by no means universal, but I think powerful, and it is the sense of an avant-garde, that much of what happened in the 60s has to be undone and inevitably will be. Now, Paolo Sorrentino, the man who directed that series for HBO, he's not a traditionalist Catholic. I don't know much about his religious orientation, but he's not creating propaganda for any party or cause. He's trying to capture what he thinks is going on. And I was very struck in one interview he gave to The Hollywood Reporter. He said that the reason he chose to depict this new pope that the series is about, Pius XIII, as a very reactionary pope, was that he thinks it's an illusion. Here I'm quoting him. It's an illusion that the church has a long-term idea towards modernity. It's just, he thinks, and I think he's absolutely right, a fantasy that the church somehow will progress to conform with the spirit of some new age. I think something else happened. It was not, the church was not opening itself to the spirit of the future. I think it instead was conforming itself to the sensibility of a particular class.
So picking up on this theme, you know, the Novus Ordo liturgy, which we have now, predominantly is the work of a particular class within a particular generation. Matthew, you have an opinion piece in the most recent issue of the UK's Catholic Herald outlining your take on post-conciliar liturgy and its effects on Catholic practice. So the piece is titled A Beautiful Church for the Poor, and it includes this paragraph. Catholics assert the coincidence of truth, goodness, and beauty. It should not surprise us then that at the same time Gregorian chant gave way to the guitar mass, Catholic truth seemed to lose its splendor, suffering mockery and challenge on every side. Nor should it surprise that this crisis in the Church's worship and teaching has coincided with an utter collapse in the Church's ministry to the poor. So could you unpack that for us?
Absolutely. When I was researching this article, I found a paper published in the journal Social Forces by a team of researchers from the University of Nebraska and Penn State. Sociologists, I've corresponded with one of them. He has no ecclesial axe to grind whatsoever. I don't think he is a Catholic, though I didn't put it to him. But he did say that he approved my kind of presentation of his data, though he didn't share or disagree with any conclusions I drew from it. He just views that it's not his business. Now, in this paper, the researchers show that Catholics are profoundly unlike Protestants in the way that income affects religious attendance. We might think that poor people tend not to go to church because they tend not to be as involved in society, or perhaps we think poor people will go to church more than rich people because they're, you know, opium of the masses, dumber and more religious. This is where sociology is useful. It can actually establish a baseline in reality. What sociologists have for a long time known is that there's actually very little difference in religious attendance between the poor and the rich. This has been observed over many cohorts across many different denominations. So it's become a commonplace of the literature that income level doesn't really matter for religious involvement. What the researchers who wrote this paper point out is that while that's true enough generally, it doesn't apply to Catholics. If you're, say, a poor Protestant, you make less than $20,000 a year, you're going to attend church almost as often as someone who makes over $200,000 a year. If you're a Catholic, though, who makes that, you will probably go to church two or three times a year, whereas a rich Catholic will attend several times a month. It's a gigantic disparity, and it indicates that there's something going on in the Catholic Church. There's a class divide, a really deep class divide that doesn't exist in any other church today in America. Now that surprised me. And the researchers do us the favor of trying to understand when this came about, though they can't finally settle just how or why it came about. What they found when they looked at Catholics in generational terms by dividing them into different age cohorts was that things shifted in the 60s. They divided them into three cohorts: people born before 1941, between 1941 and 1960, and after 1960. So you have the people who came of age before the Second Vatican Council, during it, and after it. People who came of age before the Second Vatican Council, they look just like the Protestants do today, and just as the Protestants did then. The poor go to church almost as often as the rich. It's only in the 1960s that things change for Catholics. Now, does that mean it was certainly the Second Vatican Council? Well, I mean, social science can't tell us everything, but that's one of the possibilities the researchers raise. And I think that there's a strong theoretical case to be made for that.
Now, Matthew, your analysis of these findings draws on the work of the great anthropologist Mary Douglas. So could you explain briefly who she was and what do you draw from her work?
Mary Douglas was a distinguished English academic and a Catholic who studied primitive tribes and also commented incisively on modern people. The reason she was able to comment so incisively was that she realized modern people are, in many ways, primitive tribesmen who don't realize that they are exactly that. What Mary Douglas observes is that there, you know, at the time of the Second Vatican Council, there was a tendency by an educated clerical class to systematically denigrate and persecute working class forms of piety. Now, she talks about this in terms of what she calls the bog Irish, laboring Irishmen in London and other British cities who had a very strong attachment to Friday abstinence from meat. And priests realized that this was not a totally religious ideal. They realized that some of the enthusiasm for this rite had to do with community identification and not with an identification with Christ and his suffering on the cross. And so they thought that by dispensing with this practice, they could perhaps orient the working man toward a more enlightened and ethical view on the world.
Such a deeply stupid notion, looking back on it. I can just see on the face of it, that's such a bad idea.
Right. Douglas says that. She says that they've been made insensitive to the way that other people think about things. There's no hope of turning all people into ethically sophisticated, profoundly introspective, university-educated Englishmen. It's just not going to happen. So she writes in that context. Now, it's worth saying that Pope Francis also, when he was a priest and bishop in Buenos Aires, was supportive of popular pious practices. He was not a traditionalist, but this is something that Francis at moments in his career has also understood. He would encourage his Jesuit seminarians to go up and kiss the feet of statues, as I'll see women do in churches here in New York, usually Filipino women. And sometimes they've kind of made the statues hard to get at. They'll kind of climb up over the candles and try to touch it. And it's kind of funny to see how whoever is arranging the church isn't actually servicing the needs of some of the parishioners. But Pope Francis was supportive of that kind of piety, and it profoundly—
Well, because it's, in part because it's spontaneous, right? I mean, he doesn't like rigidity, but— Yeah, something that seems authentic and spontaneous will be show up for him.
Yeah, I'm not sure. I don't know that I can characterize his thought well over his career. It seems to me that he has changed in certain ways and other things remain constant. He is, as he says, a little bit wise and a little bit naive, and it's hard to really suss out what's going on there in interior terms. But I think he had better intuitions at that moment than most people. And Mary Douglas notes this in her research. She though, I think, notes something, as you point out, that Francis doesn't quite, which is that you need a strong kind of ritual component. Things need to be formal. And often they also, my editor wanted me to write about beauty, they need to be ornate. So people often say, well, why is the Catholic Church so wealthy? Why do they have all this ornate stuff? Can't it just be simple? Or perhaps, we should let our parish be simple to show that we care about the poor. Now, say I show you two houses, one on each side of the railroad tracks. One house, it's very sparse. The color palette is muted or to the point of plainness. Very little decoration. No little statues of angels in the front yard or tchotchkes on the shelves. And then I show you a house on the other side of the tracks, and it has all of those things. It's crowded with statues. It's wildly ornate. Everything is carved. Everything is figural. Which is the house of the rich person, and which is the house of the poor person?
Certainly the first is the house of a rich person.
Right, so this kind of conceit that by making the Mass immensely plain, we were appealing to the poor, is false. Here's the ultimate point of my essay. This was by no means mandated by the Council, as Mosebach points out in his essay. But what happened at the time of the Council was that the Mass was, every attempt was made to turn it into a bourgeois rite. Bourgeoisie tends to be anti-ritual, but they tried to conform the Mass to the preferences and aesthetics of a particular class and to denigrate anyone who didn't care for it as either an aesthete, and it's true that people with more aristocratic sensibilities don't care for the Mass, or as stupid and uneducated, superstitious. So you have an effort to get rid of things like the St. Michael prayer, to which working people had a very strong attachment. I was at a Mass recently here in New York. The parish had just been just got a new priest, and the priest who was supposed to come in to say the Latin Mass didn't show. He was delayed, I guess. The new pastor of the parish came out 20 minutes after the Mass was supposed to start and began to stumble through all the rubrics, being basically dragged through it by the man attending him at the altar. When he got up to the pulpit to preach the sermon, he said, "I'm sorry, not only that things started late, but that you've had to see me stumble through this. I haven't seen this Mass, or let alone celebrated it, for 50 years since I was in seminary." And at that point, this is the first time I've ever seen it happen. I think it'll be the only time I'll ever see it happen. This church full of traditionalists broke out into applause. Deeply shocking, deeply shocking. And at the end of the homily, he began to get down from the pulpit. And there are these ladies, Filipino ladies and others in the congregation. They started whispering, kind of shout whisper. You know how it is? People shouting something whispered. They go, "St. Michael! St. Michael! You've got to do the St. Michael prayer." It's very, very important. You've got to have that. And I think at that moment I saw two things. When I saw what Mosebach says will happen in his essay, he says the Mass will be recovered not by papal fiat, but by a movement of reform from the ground up, led by the laity who have a love for Christ and for the Mass. And so there I saw this priest who hadn't done the Mass for decades be shown how to do it. I have never seen more lay participation in my life. And I saw this priest, the women led him in that prayer and led the whole congregation. And that moment is the moment that Mosebach thinks the whole church needs.
Matthew Schmitz's opinion piece, A Beautiful Church for the Poor, appeared in the February 24th issue of the Catholic Herald. It's online right now and free to all, so check it out. Martin Mosebach's feature article, Return to Form, appears in the April issue of First Things, which hits newsstands, mailboxes, and the internet on Tuesday, March 7th. Nor is that all. Elsewhere in the April issue, Christopher Caldwell surveys the new landscape of opioid addiction in America. Patrick Deneen reviews new books by Rod Dreher, Archbishop Chaput, and Anthony Esselin. China's leading human rights lawyer and a Christian recounts his struggle against the Chinese government. David Bentley Hart recommends 25 or more books you've never heard of. Rusty Reno is in the public square, and Mark Bauerlein is on the back page. If you're a subscriber, you have all this and more to look forward to. If you're not a subscriber, you have very little excuse. We publish 10 issues per year. Subscription rates start at $19.95. Visit firstthings.com/subscribe to learn more. That's all for this episode of the First Things podcast. Thanks to special guest Midge Dechter. Thanks to my colleagues, Rusty Reno and Matthew Schmitz. And thank you, listeners. Thank you.